Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and it's good to see you again, Christy.
I know, it's great to have you back.
We haven't both been together. A little longer summer and have some travel plans.
I know,
but appreciate all the work that you've been doing as some of our
likewise,
great co-hosts.
We've had some fantastic co-hosts.
Yeah.
I'm glad to be with you. Today, Adam, we get to talk with Dr. Michelle Mello, professor of law and of health research and policy at Stanford University, about the changing laws of vaccines.
Yeah, you know, the whole recent measles epidemic at Disneyland and then what happened with California changing their laws, this is really important, and I think it'll speak to a lot of parents. It may be controversial, but I think we'll have some opinions.
I think so, too. And first, we have some research that matters. We're going to talk about measles itself, about how many children are at risk for measles.
We're going to talk about the EpiPens and the things that can be life-saving, but also you can get hurt by them.
Yep, about discussing life expectancy and how that gives advanced cancer patients realistic view.
And finally, we're going to talk about football and brain injuries, a topic we've kind of broached on a little bit, but we're starting to get
shocking.
More into it.
This is a little more shocking.
Let's go right into our very first article then about measles, because we're going to be talking about vaccine diseases and policy and law. But this is just some basic epidemiology research that looks at how many children in the United States are actually at risk for measles. I found this shocking.
I found it shocking, too. The study suggesting that nearly 9 million children, that's 9 million children.
Not 9,000, not 90,000, not 900,000.
9 million children in our country, infants through age 17, are susceptible to measles primarily because they either didn't get the vaccine called the MMR, or the measles, mumps, or rubella shot, or because they only got one of the two recommended doses of the MMR. They're usually given at ages one, around 12 months, 12 to 15 months, and then the second one in that 4 to 5 to 6 years of age.
And what that means is, of all the children in the United States, 7 to 8% may not actually be immunized. And once you fall below that amount, so then the herd immunity, what they call having so many people immunized that you can't communicate this very easily, becomes much higher. And that's what happened in California. So this is a real problem. And I had a patient the other day, Christy, as an adult, he's going back to school and he needed to actually, you know, document it. He didn't have it. So we checked it. I said, oh, I'm sure you're immunized. Well, sure enough, he was not immunized he didn't have these titers, the blood levels that showed he had received them, or maybe they weren't high enough eating it too, so we had to give him the shots.
Well, yeah, they found that nearly 1 in 4 children in the most vulnerable age, ages 3 or younger, are at risk, and nearly 5% of 17-year-olds had not received any dose of the vaccine. So it's really become more common and more of a problem in our country. I'm so glad that we're going to be talking about it with an expert in just a little while.
And probably what we'll see, I think, around the country is decreased reasons why people can't get them when they go to school, which most states have laws that, you know, you have to be immunized before you go to school, but there are a lot of exemptions. I think the exemptions are going to decrease. We'll talk about that.
We sure will. Well, let's talk about EpiPens. So EpiPens are these little, you know, pens or like shots of medicine called epinephrine that can be life-saving in a situation of someone who has severe allergies and has something called anaphylaxis, which is a life-threatening emergency. And children who have these allergies need to have these EpiPens to be given at school or at home when they have those symptoms.
Yeah, and unfortunately, they can be problems because they have a sharp needle side and the other side that's not sharp. And when you inject it, that sharp needle side is supposed to go give that medicine into your thigh. And I had one of my research assistants a number of years ago, Christy, left the emergency room, got an EpiPen for an allergic reaction, got that allergic reaction again, put that pen right in their thigh. But guess what? it was the needle part was sticking out of their thumb.
Oh, I know.
Well, it went the wrong way. And that's what this article's about.
They did change the way the EpiPens are designed, so it's a little more clear that your thumb doesn't go where the
needle goes. Right.
But there are still continue to be cases. This was research that was published in Annals of Emergency Medicine online, where they identified 25 cases of these auto-injected related injuries where the needle gets stuck in a kid's leg or goes in the finger. And so there are a lot of problems with the way this thing is delivered.
And they're making advances in some of the technology, though the advance that I'd really like to see is not have it be injectable, have it be like inhalable in your nose, or other ways that we deliver other medicines rather than by injection, like we're developing vaccines like influenza. A lot of work to be going into this, because I think inherently when you're really nervous and you're shaking, a needle's probably a difficult thing. So I think it's good, it's better, but we got room to go.
In the meantime, don't forget that the child's leg should be immobilized, like hold it still, take a breath for yourself, don't hold the needle in any longer than it needs to be, and then don't ever reinsert that needle into the child. These things, that they seem like common sense, but when in an emergency, people kind of get shaky.
Thinking about common sense, this next research that matters is important, and I'm not sure it's common sense, but after I've heard it, I like it, which is, should patients want to hear and do we tell them about life expectancy when they have advanced metastatic cancer that they're probably going to die within 6 months? Do we have that conversation? Do patients want to hear that conversation?
Well, and, you know, people need to know their prognosis. I think doctors sometimes are reluctant to give it, thinking that it might take away hope or make people feel sad. But the study looked at 590 patients who had advanced metastatic cancer. They asked the patients whether their oncologist had ever given them a prognosis with life expectancy, asked them to estimate their own life expectancy, and asked them questions about their emotional distress and well-being. And the bottom line is that when the doctors where they were called a doctor talking about prognosis with advanced cancer patients, those patients had more realistic views of their life expectancy, and they didn't seem to experience any decrease in their emotional well-being.
Yeah, if you didn't have that conversation, a sizable percentage thought, well, they might live 5 years, and most
longer.
Of these people were going to live, you know, 6 months or less. And so having the conversation is important, and we would encourage that. And these patients appreciated it. This was in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, important research. What about our last research that matters, Christy?
Okay. This is, I think, alarming. This is a question about brain trauma in high school football players. So what they did was they followed high school. So we know football and women's soccer are the biggest sort of risks in terms of traumatic brain injury. But they actually placed sensors on the athletes to record the impact forces. And then they did brain scans and like mental tests to track the athletes' function over the course of the study.
And basically what they find is that these changes are occurring, adverse changes in the neurons, the basic structure of the brain, even the absence of diagnosed concussion, and a lot of these high-contact sports, which suggests that there's inherent dangers that we're not recognizing. And so you see a hard hit, you think, oh, that's a hard hit, but they get up quickly. That hard hit may have an adverse consequence. This is a huge issue. We're going to need to do a whole show on this, Christy,
totally
because
agree.
It's not just football.
It's complicated.
It's the complicated head injury sports. It's soccer. It's lacrosse. It's football. And the researchers say you can't change the nature of the sport. I'm not so certain that we can't make some changes to make it safer.
It's got to be safer. We really have to do something. Okay, that concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. And we are going to take a short break. But when we come back, Adam and I will be talking with Dr. Michelle Mello, professor of law and of health research and policy at Stanford University, about changing laws of vaccines. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Dr. Michelle Mello, Professor of Law of Health Research and Policy at Stanford University, about the changing laws of vaccines in a recent New England Journal of Medicine Perspective article she wrote.
Welcome, Dr. Mello.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
We're glad to have you. You know, you study how the law affects how we receive healthcare and how healthcare is regulated. How did you get down this path for your career?
Well, I was a political science major as an undergraduate, and what interested me was questions about the proper role of the government in people's lives. What does the government need to provide for people? What do we want to task it with providing? And on the other side, when should it stay out of people's private liberties? And that led pretty naturally into a career studying the provision of one of the most essential services, healthcare, and some of the most private behaviors, which are health-related behaviors.
You know, when we think about the laws that we assume, Christy and I, as family docs, that, well, these laws are ones that everyone likes. I mean, you know, we think about the laws that improve health, like seatbelt laws. But even the things that are commonly done, like seatbelt laws, can be controversial, correct?
Absolutely. The seatbelt law may be uncontroversial to our contemporary ears, but it certainly wasn't at the time of passage.
And so thinking about vaccines and understanding the laws around vaccines, you recently wrote in this article in the New England Journal of Medicine about exemptions to vaccine requirements. And you talked about three different types of exemptions. Break that down for us of how states kind of look at exceptions to the rule that we should vaccinate children.
Sure. So when a state requires a child to be vaccinated as a condition of attending school or preschool, it will always grant an exemption for children who have a medical contraindication, meaning there's something about their body, their immune system, that makes vaccination clinically a bad choice for them. That's required by law, by a matter of constitutional law. But states will typically also include two other types of exemptions. One is religious. So for patients whose parents have a sincere religious belief against vaccination, states will often, although not always, permit the patient to obtain an exemption from the vaccination requirement. And the third and most controversial type is the so-called philosophical exemption, in which a parent asserts not a religious exemption, but rather just a general belief that vaccinations are bad, imprudent, unwise, or wrong for their family based on other values. And those religious and philosophical exemptions are the ones that have come under the most pressure in recent years.
And, you know, in thinking about my patients here in North Carolina, you know, parents are trying really hard to make the right choice for their family. And there's all this mixed information out there and confusion. And for North Carolina, just being against it could be religious reason enough. You don't have to specify any particular type of religion. So I guess it would fall into this philosophy category. But these mothers and fathers are trying to make the right decisions for their children, and they're afraid. How does that play out typically across the nation? Is that usually what these philosophical differences are about?
I think so, that these are not parents who are trying to be a thorn in the side of the educational system. They're parents who profoundly believe that the right thing to do for their child's health is to avoid something that could cause injury to an otherwise healthy child. They look across the country and say, well, gee, a lot of these vaccine-preventable illnesses don't seem to come up very much, but I do know there's a small but not dismissible chance that my child might suffer an adverse event as related to the vaccine. And I'm just not willing to balance those risks and benefits in the way that would lead me to offer up my child for vaccination. And so how this plays out politically is that these often are mothers who are well-educated, have high social capital, high income, and who mobilize. They connect with one another on the Internet, and they form political interest groups. They have the time and resources to appear before legislatures to pack the halls when these bills are heard by legislatures, and their voices are made known, and in some states have enabled the defeat of efforts to tighten vaccination requirements, and in other states, although strident, have not succeeded in defeating those efforts.
I know we're going to get into what happened in California and why, which kind of drove a lot of real interest and in legal changes recently. But I wonder if this belief system, does it translate into political belief systems? In other words, the role of government? Because you study this. So is this really a more fundamental belief of ideology that can change with maybe knowledge? Or is it really – it's really resistant to change because it gets at something much more fundamental?
Well, it tends statistically to be associated with parents who have libertarian beliefs more broadly, who believe in a smaller role for government. But it's not exclusive. I think for some parents, this is a singular issue that does not translate into necessarily, for example, being anti-tax or anti-big government in general. But on this issue, they feel very strongly. The difficulty is when it comes, you know, when you're raising the question about education, that the sources of information that this group uses to form and solidify its views, I think to almost everyone, if not everyone in the scientific community, are simply not reputable. And one gets into a sort of a battle of internet sources with these folks. The scientific articles on which the beliefs were initially based have been widely discredited, universally discredited, but there is a stickiness to these beliefs that's very hard to dislodge. And as a parent myself, I suspect that some of this has to do with just the inordinate amount of risk aversion that we have when it comes to our children's health, that we think if there's any chance that somebody might be wrong about this, we want to do the safe thing for children. And in the eyes of some parents, this is refraining from vaccination.
Well, and you wonder, too, you know, they're educated people, but these are parents who don't see a lot of these vaccine-preventable illnesses because of the protection from herd immunity and from other benefits to the other children getting vaccinated. But you wonder if they could see how sick children can get from even something like the flu, but of measles and whooping cough and other things, that would change the perspective.
Absolutely. You know, one of the most moving things that I read during the most recent debate over measles vaccination here in California was the essay that the children's author Roald Dahl wrote in 1986 about his daughter Olivia, who died of measles at the age of 7, and the experience of being at her bedside. And I think he really wanted to remind contemporary parents that this is a real threat. And the loss is profound when there is a failure to act.
Book by Roald Dahl?
This was just an essay that he wrote on his daughter Olivia. Anybody who would be interested in reading it could just Google Roald Dahl, R-O-A-L-D-D-A-H-L, and the name Olivia, and would find it very readily.
Amazing writer.
He is. And, you know, this is not the sort of thing that he sort of had this very dry sense of humor, sort of dark side to him as well, but here is somebody who had just a life-changing experience out of, you know, at a time where vaccines were not available. And so somebody who's been in that position, the idea that someone who had a vaccine available would not use it, it must be overwhelmingly confusing.
Mm-hmm. You know, the whole impetus for perhaps your article was this kind of epidemic of measles that occurred. Tell us how you really became aware that this was happening and that your state, California, was going to be a bellwether for this nationwide outbreak.
Yes. Well, I mean, we all heard, of course, about the outbreak at Disneyland because it was Disneyland and it made headline news. But also, I moved to California from Boston just a few months before this happened. And within a month of being in the state, my 6-year-old son was exposed to pertussis at a summer camp, and I became aware very quickly that high rates of vaccination opt-outs were a very large issue in California. A quarter of our kindergartens have lost herd immunity because parents have opted out in such large numbers. So it was a very personal issue to me as a parent. And then to hear, you know, about the decisions of many parents in the wake of this measles outbreak, that some were going to move forward with vaccination where they otherwise did not perceive a risk. Others really became entrenched in their views. It quickly became a political issue that really everyone in the state was aware of.
Well, we're going to pick right up on this conversation about vaccines and about California and the measles outbreak. But we do need to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Michelle Mello, professor of law and of health research and policy at Stanford University, about the changing laws of vaccines. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Michelle Mello, Professor of Law and Health Research and Policy at Stanford University, about the changing laws of vaccines in a recent perspective article in the New England Journal of Medicine. And Dr. Mello, tell us what happened with a law change in California in response to the measles epidemic that outbroke at Disneyland.
Well, California recently became only the third state in the country to eliminate both religious and philosophical exemptions for vaccinations. And it's a strange community of bedfellows. The other two states are not states that you would typically think of as being politically aligned with California. It's West Virginia and Mississippi. But this trio has decided that medical contraindications are the only reason that a child will not be permitted to opt out of vaccination. And the move in California, which came in the middle of 2014, was a direct response to, or 2015, I'm sorry, was a direct response to the measles outbreak the previous winter. The legislature had actually recently adopted other legislation trying to tighten down and make it a little bit harder to claim those exemptions, but evidently decided it hadn't gone far enough and just eliminated them altogether.
And so how did that actually get achieved? Where, I mean, I imagine there are grand arguments of why someone's religion, I mean, I could see maybe cutting out philosophy, but why someone's, you know, personal, family, religious, philosophical rights should trump the government. What were some of the political nuances or arguments that happened in that debate in the legislature that got it overturned?
Well, you know, the posture of this was such that they were able to avoid a focus on religious exemptions in particular. And the reason for that is that California had just a blanket personal belief exemption that folded together the other two types
okay.
that I had talked about, religious and philosophical. And to my recollection, most of the opposition in the legislature was not from religious acceptors. It was from folks who were claiming the more general personal belief exemptions. So I think the legislature was fortunate in that this wasn't primarily framed as an argument about religious liberty, but rather a more general personal liberty. And those kinds of arguments were able to be defeated in this case because of a couple of things. The measles outbreak, I think, certainly was one that highlighted that exercising this particular personal liberty had a profound and real social cost.
Mm-hmm.
And the other was that the proponents of the legislation were able to hold up as kind of poster children in this debate a couple of kids who were too medically fragile to receive vaccinations themselves. And one of them was a beautiful and very well-spoken 7-year-old named Rhett Crowett, who came and testified and gave speeches around the state, emphasizing that for others to exercise this personal liberty had a profound impact on kids like him, who could not receive vaccines, yet who had to, by law, attend school along kids who chose not to receive them.
Mm.
And that really shifted the frame of the debate to focus not on the question of liberty so much as the question of harm to others.
So the rights of an individual versus the rights of groups. And this is in a public realm because you're talking about school and not being able to go to school. Does it translate also, in your article you say that the Supreme Court has upheld this so that it would not be surprising that it will be defended legally, but what about can private companies do this? For instance, hospitals around the country are making policies that you as employees have to get flu shots and you could lose your job. Does it translate that? Do they have more freedom or less freedom?
Well, as a general matter, private companies would have more freedom to impose conditions of employment like that because they're not subject to the dictates of the U.S. Constitution and, in particular, the Religious Liberty Clause of the First Amendment. But your listeners may want to know that, actually, as a matter of law, California itself now requires some employees, those who work in daycare centers, to receive vaccinations for flu, pertussis, and measles as of yesterday. Governor Brown signed that new legislation.
Oh, wow.
Unless there's a medical exemption.
unless there's a medical exemption.
And you mentioned in your article that there could be some unintended consequences of legislation. And I was fascinated by the fact that there could be a cottage industry of providers of some sort providing medical exemptions. Do you think that's likely to happen?
You know, I don't know how likely it is that physicians would hold themselves out as serving that function and have some risk for them that they might be accused of practicing medicine inappropriately. But again, the anti-vaccination community is very well connected, and it wouldn't surprise me that there are some who are very dedicated to maintaining their status as exemptors who might communicate that a particular provider was willing to issue a medical exemption in particular cases. But I think the more likely outcome for folks who want to avoid vaccinations is to choose alternative schooling arrangements that take them out of the purview of the law.
And so, but children who go to private schools in California still have to get their vaccinations, right?
That's right. So homeschooling would be the alternative, and although that may seem like a radical step to many of us, again, for this particular population that does tend to have, you know, not a great affinity for government and public services, that may not be a radical choice.
So what will happen to surrounding states? I mean, will there be, I guess people could pack up and move. but, I mean, do you think that other states will follow? Like, is this a movement that is big enough as you see children, innocent children, you know, dying of vaccine-preventable illness, do you think this is really leading the way and that in a way that others will follow?
I think it's very possible. I think there's a tendency to view California as sui generis, that there's so many things that people think are weird about California that it's easy to say, well, that could never happen in my state. But now look at, again, this trio of states that have accomplished these quite stringent vaccination laws. Two red states and one very blue state. I think what it suggests is that if there is sufficient legislative backbone, these kinds of initiatives can survive. And that may re-embolden other states that have tried and failed to tighten things down, that may take some cues from how California handled things politically, the arguments that it used, the circumstances in which it was pressed, i.e. in the immediate wake of an outbreak, and may indeed move forward with renewed attempts to tighten things down.
One of the things you mentioned in your article, which I think is an important, and I don't know if you had an answer, and I certainly don't have an answer, but is the kind of the cost of and the enforcement of, you know, you pass a law, but if you don't enforce it, and who's going to enforce it, and who's going to pay? Because presumably there's a lot more administrative costs to really track and follow up. What thoughts do you have? Anything we have models that work either other countries or other states, those other states you mentioned?
Yeah, it's an important point. One of the things that's sort of funny about vaccination laws in the United States is that generally it's the schools that are tasked with enforcing them. For all kinds of other public health regulations that restrict people's liberty, it's the public health department that is tasked with enforcing them. And in my view, it puts schools in a very awkward position. You know, here they are, they've got a new kindergartner, they're trying to form a trusting relationship with the child and parents, and the first thing the state's asking them to do is send them home because they have, their paperwork is not in order, they're refusing vaccinations. There's not much room for them to work with parents to negotiate a solution. And in general, I think it's a very difficult position to put daycare centers and schools in. It would be much better, in my view, if public health departments took direct responsibility for enforcing it. They have more tools, and they have an arm's-length relationship. They're not also, at the same time, trying to create a trusting and educational relationship with children.
Well, and even still, the protection in California, I guess that will protect the children who live in California. But you can't really do anything about Disneyland. I guess you protect the locals who go to Disneyland, but not the rest of the children who are coming and the tourists who are coming from all over.
Well, that's right. But we have to remember that if we would like government to do something that restricts people's liberties, we have to give them what lawyers would call a jurisdictional hook. There has to be something about the government's relationship to a person that creates an opportunity to assert authority over them. And availing yourself of government services is one of those hooks. And that's why school entry mandates tend to be about school entry and are not just a general mandate to go and do something.
Mm-hmm.
I think as we saw in the federal context when the government tried to do this with the Affordable Care Act insurance coverage mandate, the courts too that said, look, you can't impose this requirement just as a condition of existing. It's got to be tied into some activity. And school entry is a pretty good one. You know, most people go to public or private school, and that's a reasonable touch between the government and individuals and for the government to interpose itself. And it also makes sense on fairness grounds that if you want to come to public school or private school and come into contact with other kids you're going to enter into a sort of social compact that you're not going to endanger them with contagious disease.
So last question. As a parent yourself, having just moved to California, I can imagine you may come across other parents who are conflicted or unsure of what to think about these types of regulations. What guidance do you help give them to help make sense of this in ways that perhaps would resonate with our listeners?
You know, and I'm sure you know this as physicians, it's very difficult. Again, these are not uneducated people or people who haven't taken the time to read up on the issue. They've read a great deal. And so it's difficult to engage them without getting into a source-by-source debate about what is and is not credible evidence. But, you know, there's not much more one can do, I think, than to point parents to CDC and to others who have digested this literature and offered, I think, a very credible rebuttal of their claims. The unfortunate thing is that's not going to work for most parents. This is just very, very difficult beliefs to dislodge.
So you have to agree to disagree, but legally there is a law now.
Yeah, you know, the law has sort of resolved this argument, and it's one of these cases where, you know, we have many public health laws where we could argue about the evidence. Is there enough for this sort of thing? This
right.
is one area. The evidence is absolutely overwhelming.
It's overwhelming.
And there's just no dissensus within any community of scientists about this. And so, I think this is one area where I feel pretty comfortable as a health lawyer about the content of the law, even though it involves coercion on individuals. It's something that is so well justified, so well documented on the basis of the evidence that I think, as a parent, I can feel okay about compliance.
Well, we appreciate the great work that you're doing. We will put up a link on our blog to the CDC, FAQs for parents who have concerns about vaccine safety, and point
frequently
them back
asked, to frequently asked questions.
Frequently asked questions on the CDC.gov website. We'll put that on our blog just for listeners who would like a reliable source of information about this as well. Thank you, Dr. Mello, for being with us and for the great work you're doing.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our executive producer, Daniel Lane, to read us our very first House Call question about snake bites, something that none of us really like.
I recently moved to a new apartment complex, and in the first few weeks I've lived here, I've seen 3 copperhead snakes. I generally see them from pretty far off, but I'm worried what might happen if I'm walking in the dark and don't see one. What do I need to do if I get bitten?
Creepy crawly.
Well, I was taking a walk in some wetlands over the weekend, Christy, and we saw some snakes. We actually saw some gators, some porcupines, all kinds of things you don't really like. But this is a really interesting question because there's a lot more probably not to do than to do. Like, we used to think, oh, you make those incisions and you suck out, that you see
it
on TV all the time.
You see it on TV and movies.
You're not supposed to do that because you'll do more harm than good. And same thing goes with like ice packs or heat packs. They're not really recommended because there's more harm than good.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I would say to always remember, we always talk about prevention. So if you know there are copperhead snakes out there, then I would encourage you not to walk through there in the dark when you're barefoot. You know, wear some shoes that have some ankles on them or make a lot of noise before you go start walking through the grass. But the one thing, if you get bitten by a snake that you're concerned is a poisonous snake, if you get bitten by a snake, it's worth going and getting that checked out in an emergency department or an urgent care because that person can help determine, the physician can help you determine if you need any sort of anti-venom or any sort of medication to try to prevent it from getting worse. And a lot of times it's a matter of just keeping your ankle still and sometimes raised or making
sure
that—
But lower than the level of your heart because you don't really want to Like you want to kind of keep that blood flow. So anything is a big thing. Get to the hospital. Get to a care. And if you're not really certain, still get there anyhow. Even if, because I wouldn't necessarily know if it was a copyright. I would just know, boy, that snake looked really bad.
He looked bad.
We can put pictures of those poisonous snakes
Let's
on
do
our
that.
Website.
We will ask our fantastic health sciences librarians to put up some pictures of the poisonous snakes, the most common poisonous snakes to look out for.
Daniel, what's our very next house call?
We recently had a coworker go into cardiac arrest at the office. After a few days at the hospital, he's thankfully okay, but several of us at the office would like to be more prepared if something were to happen in the future. Do you know any good resources for CPR or AED training?
Wow, glad to hear that he is okay. And it sounds like that was really scary for everyone. I think it's a really good idea to think for yourself and just think, you know, all kinds of ways in the community where you might want to know a little something about what to do in those types of an emergency. So getting CPR trained is a really good idea.
I think if you're, you know, if you're in an organization where you have AEDs, these defibrillators, you should have some practice time, some practice sessions. We pull them out. Everyone gets to look at it, kind of go through the steps, kind of like you do a fire drill. Mm-hmm. That would be a really good thing as a training. And also the Heart Association does trainings for people regularly.
Yeah, so you could look on the American Heart Association website and see if you could find a local chapter that does CPR training. There are all kinds of options in your community. So if you just Googled CPR training in your city or town, you could probably find several options of how
American
to get
Red
that
Cross.
Training.
Uh-huh. American Red Cross does them. We'll put up again, ask our great health science librarians to put up a link to the AED trainings that at least where you can go for Heart Association or Red Cross, because they're national, and then you can Google down into your states.
And you may want most people to have the CPR training and then one or two people to have that AED training to really understand how to use that machine. Let's have our next house call question.
I'm a 47-year-old male who is a little overweight, and I get occasional heartburn. Normally, I would take Tums or Zantac, and it would be fine, but over the past month or so, it's been getting more frequent, medicine doesn't work as well, and it seems to hurt more. I also frequently take Naproxen for knee pain. Should I switch to a different heartburn medication, or should I see a doctor?
Yes, and yes, and uh-huh. Maybe there's another yes in there.
Yes.
What do you think, Christy?
Well, you know, the thing that jumps up out, of course, is the Naproxen that you're taking, which is an anti-inflammatory medication that can make your tummy more upset. You can get gastritis where your stomach gets irritated and inflamed, and it can really make, if you have acid reflux or you have trouble with your stomach, it can make it worse. So that's one thing. And then the other is if it's happening more frequent and it's more painful, definitely go get that checked out. There could be simple things in your life that you could do, like, you know, identifying foods that make it worse and not eating those foods or not eating late at night right before you go to bed. But if it's getting more frequent and that much worse, I'd stop the Naproxen and go talk to your doctor.
Yeah. And you said you're a little overweight, little hint, hint, maybe losing a little bit of weight, smaller meals,
mm-hmm.
These sort of things could actually reduce the, you know, one of the potential causes. Maybe you're doing other things that are causing it. You may be having caffeine. Hopefully you're not smoking. Talk with your doctor. Make some suggestions. We applaud you for bringing up the question. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Let's take our next house call question.
I'm a 26-year-old female, and I recently have been getting stomach pain, nausea, bloating, and constipation after meals. About the same time this started, I started getting an itchy skin rash, and after a recent blood test, my doctor told me I was a little anemic, so now I'm taking extra iron. Do you have any idea what it could be?
Wow. There's a lot of things going on here. This reminds me, Christy, of one of those things that, you know, it's almost like, you know, two or three different things are happening. And the question is, are they all related or are
mm-hmm.
they unrelated? Because the rash may not have anything to do with the other elements, but yet you're anemic, which may or may not have. I mean, are these things all related?
Right. And, you know, it's very plausible or possible that they're not related, that you have some anemia maybe from being a young woman with heavy periods, that you have some upset in your stomach, and bloating could be related to stress or could be related to a whole lot of different things that could cause that. And the rash, gosh, it's hard for us to do a rash that just sort of works in there by phone. Did you come up with anything, Adam, that would tie it all together?
There are some things. I mean, you could have some celiac symptoms and,
sure.
you know, people can't absorb things, B12. But the reality is most likely there's some separate things going on that in your own mind are together. I would encourage you to go make an appointment with your doctor. Make sure you got enough time because this is going to be
mm-hmm.
one that
this
you have to sort through.
It might require a couple different visits with your doctor.
Yeah. Hopefully you're not allergic to that iron, which is unlikely.
Mm-hmm. but that could give you stomach upset. Yeah, this could go on. This is a really complicated one. Okay, thank you for your question, and we hope that you're able to see your doctor and feel better soon.
And we want to thank you all for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you. You can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu or visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or search and join our app.
We want to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our great guest today, Dr. Michelle Mello. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.